Morning, everybody. For those of you that don't know me, my name is Peter. I'm a partner with a specialist employment law and business immigration practice called MPM Legal. We're based in the UK, but we work with clients that are all over the world and they have a common interest, which is employing people here in the UK. And that's where we help them. Delighted as ever to be joined by my colleague, Adrienne. Good morning, Adrienne.
Good morning, everybody.
Before we get into today's session, just a couple of housekeeping points, if I may. So for those of you that are joining live, welcome. Great to see so many of you, some new and some familiar names as well. If you want to ask us a question, we'll try and deal with them as we go along or before we get to the end today. Just use the Q&A function down at the bottom because it just helps us to manage the questions when we get quite a lot. It's easier for us to manage if they're in the Q&A rather than in the chat. If you do want to chat to other people, make any comments, of course, you can use the chat function. So go ahead with that. If you are listening to us today on Spotify or Amazon Music, everything we're talking about is relevant as at the 25th of April, 2024. I've just got to say that because we're getting quite a lot of people listening on Spotify now and this stuff can go out of date sometimes. By the way, if you've missed any of our last sessions, they're all on Spotify now and we've actually just launched a new page on our website. I'll put a link to it in the chat function actually. So if you want to see these recordings, the webinar videos and our back catalogue of the sessions we've been running since September, October time, have a look on our website. I'll put the link through for you to have a look through. Adrienne, what are we talking about today?
We are talking about the knotty problem of managing underperforming employees. And I think, you know, I think it's fair to say that it's something that comes up quite a lot and there's a variety of issues that arise out of it. But I think we'll be starting off with a point that obviously underperformance comes under the heading of capability, which is one of the potentially fair reasons for dismissal, of which there are five. So you can dismiss somebody for underperformance, as I'm sure you all know, but there is a very set process in order to get you from the A to B, the underperformance through to dismissal, if that's the case. We're going to approach today's session not on the basis of what should I say, where I think that you might believe that a successful process would work. If I'm honest, we're kind of starting from the back end of how to deal with it, which is going to be problematic. And you can foresee that because I think probably most of you would probably put hand on heart and say, you know, when somebody's going to work out, you know, when performance management is probably going to work and you probably have a pretty good feel for when you don't think it will. So we're going to look at situations where it's going to be a little bit tricky. And I think the best way for us to do it is just talk through a typical scenario and work through that to give you some of our hints and tips and some war stories, perhaps, of where we've been in these situations. So typical situation, a client comes to us with you know, so the typical situation where they've got an employee, let's assume they've got over 2 years service, who's just not performing, and they want to know what the next steps are, including how to put them on a performance improvement plan, which is commonly known as a PIP. And we're not going to cover in detail about the process that you've probably all got set out in your policies and that you're familiar with. So we're going to focus on some difficult bits. So, Peter, where's the starting point? What are some of the things that we would typically ask in this scenario?
Yeah, I just want to mention the significance of the 2 year period is employees can't bring what we call an ordinary unfair dismissal claim if they don't have 2 years continuous employment. So somebody can't bring a claim under the Employment Rights Act for ordinary unfair dismissal without that qualification period. And that can be quite significant in determining for you as an employer which path you go down, you know, what the best way through is. Just want to flag though that because of that 2 year qualification rule, it's not uncommon for us to see employees trying to allege other types of claims that don't have 2 year service requirements. So we're talking about whistleblowing claims, a certain statutory right, Equality Act type claims. So that should also feed into your decision making process because, you know, if you think that inequality of treatment underpins any kind of discrimination claim, if you're treating two employees differently in terms of a particular process, tribunals will examine and look and see whether that can form the basis of a claim under the Equality Act. So inconsistent treatment for a male being performance managed versus a female, for example, or somebody who's disabled versus somebody who isn't disabled. So just bear that in mind. I just want to point that out. Back to your question, Adrienne. I mean, The big word for me to describe all of this is communication. I think that's going to be a theme that kind of runs through, and in terms of where we've seen things go wrong in the past, which is quite commonplace, it's where there's a communication breakdown quite often. But what does that kind of look like in practice? What does it start with? Well, for me, central to this is the importance of good managers. So before we kind of skip to looking at, an individual employee who is underperforming, what's the management of that person like? And you and I, we've had this discussion before. The amount of times that we've seen, for example, good lawyers, good employment lawyers, don't make good managers of other lawyers. Good finance people don't make good managers of other finance people automatically. Just because you've got someone who's a really high performing salesperson, we see quite a lot in that environment, and they're selling the most number of widgets anybody in your company has ever sold, it doesn't translate to them being a decent manager. So for me, part of this is, how are you upskilling your managers? How are you equipping them, especially newly promoted people? Do they know where those boundaries lie? Do they know about having difficult conversations, right? Back to this communication piece. How are you equipping them with the tools that they need to manage effectively? So are you giving them sufficient training? Do they know how to have difficult conversations? Do they know kind of where the boundaries lie in terms of what they can raise with an employee informally versus, what needs to be wrapped up in some kind of formal process? So, that's a kind of massive part not to overlook. I can see you want
Yeah,
to.
I mean, I'm just going to cut in there and say that it comes up in pretty much every manager training session that I've run. So if a company comes and says, right, we've got a bunch of new managers, we want to give them the skills, and first of all, I congratulate them because, as Peter says, just because they're a good salesperson doesn't automatically mean they're a good manager. And whereas, we in this space would think, well, it's really obvious how to manage people, it's actually not. It's an entirely different skill set. But yeah, so when I'm doing manager training and we might be talking through some typical scenarios, and I might suggest that they sit down with their employee quite early on and say something like, "Oh, you seem to be struggling with that. That's not quite what I was looking for." Is, the managers will very often say, "Oh, can we say that?" Because basically they don't know, and sometimes they're terrified of how to ask. And so, I mean, that for me is shining a spotlight on exactly what you're saying, Peter, is that managers sometimes are very under-equipped to deal with things in
Yeah,
the
it's that
moment.
uncertainty. And actually, think about it logically. Why would you know? If you're managing someone, you've not been given any guidance. Maybe it's your first managerial position, first time you've led a team, even if just responsible for one person. How would you naturally know what you can say and what you can't say when you've got an employee who might not be performing in the way that you want them to? So that's a big component of it. The other stuff that we're looking for then is this informal stage. So have expectations been set of the employee? Is it reasonable for you to be able to say they ought to know what they're doing in this job and they ought to know what their shortcomings are? So have you kind of set the rules in terms of the employee, in terms of things like their KPIs, their objectives? Is their job description sufficiently clear as well?
Do they even have a job
Do they even
description?
have a job description, which they might not? I mean, related to that is the dreaded question of appraisals. And I know there's been debates over the years within the HR community about the real value in doing appraisals. We have some clients that will do 6 monthly appraisals. We have clients that don't bother with appraisals at all. We have clients that do an annual appraisal process, which is probably the most common approach to take. We see lots of issues around that. The main one's probably to do with inconsistency of feedback, but also inconsistency in as much as, I'm sure you've had these conversations with clients, Adrienne, where somebody's underperforming and HR will be tearing their hair out. So they'll say, well, look at the last appraisal. They've been rated as good or as doing a really
Meets
good job.
expectations.
Exceeds expectations. And we always say, well, how can it be that 3 months ago, let's say, somebody's exceeding expectations or meeting expectations, and now you're coming to us to say, how do we solve this problem? This person isn't performing very well at all. Or the manager didn't want to give that feedback, or it was a really tough time for the employee and the manager didn't want to say a particular thing. And we understand the sentiment behind that and where it's coming from, the motivation, but in pure employment law terms, it's not particularly helpful, not least because the employee's expectations have been set in a different way. And you know, as soon as you start trying to address that, understandably, the employee is going to be saying, well, hang on a moment. What about this piece of paper here with appraisal written on the top, which I've read as me doing an excellent job? You know, there aren't any concerns flagged there. The other thing is in relation to discussions already, just one-to-one check-ins. You know, for those of you that don't have formal appraisals every year, that's fine. What mechanism is there, though, for that dialogue, that communication again between the manager and the team? How are they kind of monitoring? How are they feeding back just on an informal basis? Because, you know, one of the other golden rules for me is by the time you get to the stage of a formal performance improvement process, a PIP or plan, there shouldn't be any surprises. It shouldn't come as a surprise to the individual who's affected. And I think if you get to the point where an individual's turning around and saying, wow, where's this come from? I think I've been doing an amazing job. Something has already gone wrong somewhere. So it's about those kind of building blocks to start off with. I mentioned PIP, Adrian. What have you seen that goes into kind of making a good PIP process?
Yeah, and I think PIPs are, for certain roles, they're really easy, right? So if you've got a sales role, you can set some numbers, you can set some targets. For other roles, it's a bit more difficult, but fundamentally, we need a PIP to be set for a decent period of time. Let's talk about that to start with. People say, how long will a PIP process take? Well, you know, we might see it where a review period might be a month, but it could be 2 weeks, it could be 4 weeks. It really just, it's so specific to the role that's needed and your organization. So it's about being able to justify your review periods. But typically you would see three periods, because you'd go, here's the formal PIP. These are our expectations set over the first review period. And at the end of it, we'll sit down and see where you're up to. And then if they're still not performing, then you'd say, right, okay, we're into the second review period. These are the things you did well. These are the things you need to work on, and we'll review it at this stage. And then there's a final period where you would then be saying, still not made it. At the next review period, you need to be aware that your employment might end. So that's kind of your PIP period. But in terms of what's set in it, it's coming back to those SMART objectives. And this is so important, because the employee needs to be very, very clear on what's expected of them. And if there is any ambiguity, then that's going to be something where it will fall down. So, you know, improve behaviours in sales meetings is something that I've seen. Well, what does that actually mean? Because the employee needs to understand what they're doing wrong, what good behaviour looks like, and then how they're going to put it right. So it's making sure, coming back to Peter's point about your point about communication, does the employee have a clear understanding of what they're doing? As I said, in sales, it's great. It's like, by this date, you should hit this target. This is what you should have closed. These are the number of meetings you should have. These are the number of calls. But in a different type of role where that's more difficult, this is where you need to say to the manager, what exactly do you understand by underperformance for this particular employee? What is it that they're not doing correct? And it may be that you can have a compare and contrast. So you can have somebody else doing the same role where they're delivering what you need. And then it's a way of explaining to the employee, highlighting the difference. Okay. So giving the examples of underperformance, go, on this occasion, this is what you did. That's not what we want to see. This is what we want to see, and we want you to work on that, and then we'll talk again at the end of this review period, for example.
Yeah, I think having that framework in place, or I think the ideal is that everybody at a moment in time within the organization has an understanding of what good performance in their particular role looks like. And I think that feeds into something else that we see quite a lot of, and I'm sure, you know, those of you joining today have no doubt encountered this at some point in your careers as well. New manager coming in to manage a team, starts managing proactively. What has that caused for us? You know, we see employees saying, oh, hang on a moment, I never had an issue with my old manager. You know, I was just ticking along nicely, and now so-and-so's come in to manage me, and all of a sudden I'm not performing, or, you know, I'm being shown to be underperforming in some way. And really all that's happened is, you know, somebody keen has come in and they've got the skills and they are managing properly, whereas a previous manager, for whatever reason, hadn't been doing an adequate job of the management side of it. And I know that ties in with what I said at the start about equipping managers. But also, I think having the kind of standards in place that are really transparent and visible to people just helps with that consistency point. And it sort of heads off a situation where potentially you've got somebody saying, well, I'm not underperforming and I'm now going to stick a grievance in against my manager,
Yeah.
which, we
I'm
see.
being bullied. I'm being bullied and micromanaged by my new manager.
And we see
But
that
don't you
all
think,
the time.
yeah, don't you think that comes back round to part of the manager training? So, this is about communication then with the new manager, because you're right, we do see this all the time, and I'm sure there's plenty of people out there nodding their heads. But then it's about making sure that the new manager comes in is completely aware of what has or hasn't been done before they step in. And sometimes a little bit of patience. I know that's something that businesses often get to the point where they go, right, I've had enough. But that's very often it's like a little bit of patience. So that's treading gently to start with. If the new manager is thinking, this person's not up to scratch, it's a question of encouraging them just to take a moment and find out what's been done. And if nothing has been done, then it's accepting really that it's starting at the beginning of a more supportive conversation, I would suggest. You seem to be struggling with this, the question that I've just said, so that the new manager then has a bit of time to bed in, give the employee the chance to understand their way of working before you go banging in, even with an informal performance conversation that might be a bit more harsh. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, completely. And actually, someone's just asked a question which is relevant to this. So let me just deal with it now. What can you do in that scenario then if the new manager arguably is doing the right thing, but the previous manager hasn't stepped in, so there maybe hasn't been a consistency of feedback? Well, I think the fact that a situation might have been managed poorly, if I can characterize it this way, I know it's not always going to be as black and white as that. But if a new manager comes in and is doing things properly and it identifies an issue, just because somebody previously hasn't managed that scenario correctly or adequately, it's not a reason not to start managing it going forward. So I think absolutely, if you, the thing to check is that the new manager has legitimate concerns, they're being reasonable in terms of their expectations. Now, assuming that is the case, then absolutely it's right that the new manager should manage the situation. I raise the point because you're going to find potentially a challenge from an employee, because it's the employee that's being managed that's going to say, this isn't good, this is bullying, my manager's got it in for me, I'm going to raise a grievance because of the inconsistency before. But you just need to be aware of that potential, blip in the road, basically. And the answer to it might be, well, actually, there's no evidence of bullying. All we can see is that the manager's trying to do the right thing in terms of helping you with your performance, and we can show objectively that you aren't performing at the level we need you to be at. The place that we'd like you to be at ideally is not in that scenario in the first place. So how do you set yourselves up to be in a situation where all of your managers are managing consistently? They've got that skill set to kind of avoid inconsistency of treatment being flagged up in the first place. In terms of other tricky issues then, Adrienne, one we get asked quite a lot about is employees not agreeing to the performance improvement plan, not agreeing to the PIP, and what do we do there? Actually, there isn't a requirement for PIPs to be agreed. Now, we think it's obviously best if you're talking to an employee who's not performing, you can have a sensible grown-up conversation with them, you can get them to see your point of view, they get it, and you do get them on board in terms of what the performance plan looks like. And I think we'd always recommend that you do canvas that feedback and give the employee some agency in the process. So, they feel like they've got some influence over their future. And, as part of that, they've got some influence in terms of what they need to deliver on over the performance improvement process. But if the employee's been obstructive and you don't think they're being very reasonable, they don't have to agree it. It's not going to stop you from unilaterally saying, well, actually, these are the requirements we've got in place, and we've tried to talk to you about it. We've taken on board some of your feedback, but this is what we need you to do now, and this is how you're going to be managed. I think that's going to be fine. I don't think that's, particularly controversial. Of course, it's subject to you acting reasonably overall. You think about components in terms of the employment relationship, duty of good faith, mutual trust and confidence. So you don't want to act in a way that undermines the employment relationship, but really you want to be the super reasonable one. And if the employee is being unreasonable and this matter ever escalates into litigation, then that will come out. Tribunals are quite adept at spotting employees who are being obstructive and not particularly helpful. So I think try and agree something with them, but if you can't, you can escalate to just acting unilaterally.
I'm just going to add in on that as well, that if absolutely, I agree with that. But I also think it's a question of then the reasonableness. So, for example, I might see sales people being put on a PIP and they're being given a number, and they would come and say, I can't possibly achieve that number because of X, Y, and Z. And they'll bring up a bunch of business reasons as to why that number's not achievable. And there is then risk in you just carrying on willy-nilly, because ultimately, if push comes to shove, you're going to end up in one of two situations, either looking to pay the employee off or justifying to the tribunal. So let's just talk about justifying to the tribunal. If the tribunal says to you, the employee challenged whether or not they could meet this number, and they put forward all the business reasons as to why not, you've just got to make sure that you've got your own business reasons to demonstrate that that's reasonable. So, what due diligence has been done to arrive on that number? We see it where people go, well, this was my number this year, and it's gone up 66% next year, and it's just not achievable, and there's no way that I can do it. So it's having those good business reasons. And if you have, then you know that you're going to be on much firmer ground just to say, look, this is why, and this is why we're doing it. And one of the things that can be quite helpful, coming back to the comparator point, is if you've got other people doing the same job and you go, well, they're hitting it. These are the number of meetings they're going to. This is what they did for Q1. And you can see, therefore, how you're lagging behind. And all of that then builds into this picture of reasonableness.
Yeah, absolutely. The other tricky area that we get, which I'll just deal with this first, and then we've had a kind of related question to that as well, is around employees going off sick. So again, it's not an uncommon scenario for someone to start to be performance managed, or there's a discussion about the prospect of a performance management plan, and the employee then goes off sick and says, "I'm too stressed out, can't come into work." Happens quite a lot. I think the mistake to make is just to let it languish and don't do anything for a long time, kind of for fear of doing the wrong thing. You are entitled to take steps to manage that sickness absence. So, of course, you're going to have policies and procedures in place, and you should stick to those. By the way, our last 101 session 2 weeks ago, and the recording is out there now as well, was on managing long-term sicknesses and some of the really tricky aspects of that that we see. So have a look on Spotify and on our website for the video of that. Just manage it, basically. Now, what does that look like? Well, trying to still have a dialogue with the employee, so regular contact until such time as the employee might say, back off, don't want to hear from you. Send them off to see occupational health. You might be a large enough organization. Some of our clients have got internal occupational health working that they can access. Lots of
And I think on that, you'd be asking the question. You'd be saying, look, we're really concerned that you've gone off sick following, discussions around performance, and we really want to help you. And to do that, we need you to see occupational health to see what can be done, what issues are concerned, whether it's as part of the process or at work, whatever, because that way that's informing what you then do. And I don't think there's any danger in doing that. I certainly would advocate doing that sooner than you might otherwise do for any other type of period of long-term sickness.
Yeah, that's
I
right.
think you,
Ability to engage piece. And the other thing is, it doesn't mean that you have to disregard all the performance concerns. Now, obviously, if occupational health flags some underlying medical issue which is really impaired or impacted on the individual's performance, that is a different matter, and that is something to address separately. But if it's just a case of waiting for the individual to come back to work, once they're well enough to engage in the process, you're entitled to effectively put on ice those performance concerns and just pick up where you left off. So it's not a case of, I think sometimes employees might think, well, if I go off sick for a month or two, all this stuff's just going to disappear. And it doesn't, or it shouldn't. You've still got legitimate concerns that you need to address, and you're entitled to do that. So just touching on that, this question, Adrienne, we've had about what happens if someone's raised mental health concerns prior to commencing a performance improvement plan. What do you think about that?
Well, I think then you're into at the minute somebody is raising mental health concerns, particularly where they might call out something specific, where they talk about depression, anxiety, ADHD, autism, something like that. That's absolutely a trigger for you to go and get more medical evidence. And I know we bang on about occupational health, and I know some people will go, we can never find a decent provider. But it's a question of, well, we need some medical evidence to find out more about what they're saying. And I suppose my view on that is, the sooner we go, the sooner we're informed. And you know, for me, there's also that piece that in order for it to qualify as a disability, it's got to have lasted or is likely to last 12 months or more. So the longer you leave it, in a way, the more you are into that period of it lasting. So I'd jump on it straight away, and it's almost like doing a risk assessment. The minute you know that there's something that needs to be dealt with, investigate it and look at what adjustments might be put in place. Because it's only going to escalate, and one of two things will happen. Either occupational health will come back and say they're stressed at work and we recommend that the issues at work should be resolved and parties should work together and then it should be okay. In which case then you go to the employee and go, well, this is what Oc Health has recommended, let's have a conversation. Or they will give you the medical evidence and they will give you the reasonable adjustments. And if they are reasonable, then you're best advised to put them in place. It's playing a bit of a patient game, which really frustrating times, but the earlier you start to play the game, the more quickly you're going to get to a resolution.
Yeah. Maria's very kindly said that she works with a great OH. Yeah, if you don't mind DMing me on LinkedIn, Maria, that would be amazing. Please, I'll gladly look at a recommendation and then I can share it. So thank you.
Yeah. Or maybe Maria doesn't want to share it because then they'll get super busy and then
God help Maria's clients.
No.
The other question we've had is, when you speak about the informal stage and having a conversation to inform the employee that you've noticed areas of underperformance, would you recommend that still in some way documented? So how do you document an informal part of feedback? I mean, I absolutely still document it. I mean, yeah, it's going to be over the top to document it in a really formal way, because the point is you're trying to address it as part of day-to-day or week-to-week management of somebody. But, you know, there's some value if you have a one-to-one session of sending an email in summary of, hey, here are the points we discussed today. You know, we talked about this thing that's happening within the business. We talked about your professional development. We talked about how I had a few concerns about, you know, your performance last month and what steps I'm going to take to try and help you get to where you need to be. It just creates a bit of a breadcrumb trail, really. And it's back to this point about equipping managers so they know where the boundaries lie, what's appropriate to say, what's inappropriate to say. And just giving them the confidence, really, to be able to raise this sort of stuff on an informal basis. And as this question shows, you know, what practical steps to take just to protect themselves and create that little breadcrumb trail as well. I mean, it's for sure it's going to help you if an employee then in a month's time says, because we've seen this, believe me, oh, no one's ever raised anything with me before. I'm really shocked and surprised by this. You say, hang on a moment, what about these emails or what about these, you know, notes of your one-to-one meetings where we can clearly see it referenced? So I think it helps both sides, really, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, even if it's a case of let's be really super supportive. So the follow-up email might be exactly as Peter said. And, you know, don't forget, we talked about these resources. Here's where to find them. Don't forget to go and speak to David, for example, because he's willing to help you out when you get stuck. So it's about showing not only that you've had the conversation, but that you are being supportive as well, because I always come at it from the point of view of what's an employment judge going to make of all the paperwork that's in front of them. And if they see stuff that, you know, is going to well, I mean, I know I'm looking at it from a tribunal point of view, but it's also good management practice, obviously.
Now, let's talk a bit before we wrap up about the tribunal side of things, because obviously that's where, if things do carry on going wrong, where you can ultimately end up. So what does that look like?
Yeah, so I mean, I had a client take a tribunal case the whole way, because they're absolutely adamant they weren't going to settle. And I, you know, having reviewed the case, I could see why. So they ended up running an informal process followed by a formal PIP process. And the employee was challenging at every stage. So he wouldn't agree the PIP. He delayed attending PIP meetings by being off sick. And then he appealed the outcome of every PIP review along the way, and of course that just slowed things down. But I thought the manager, supported by HR, were really, really good, because if the employee didn't agree the PIP, instead of just going, nope, right, that's it, it's in place, they just went, right, well, we'll adjust this for the first couple of weeks and then we'll ramp it up to see how you're doing. They, you know, they did things like making sure that the manager checked in during the review period, and not just waiting to the end of the first month, but it was still having the weekly one-to-ones to provide support. They set up a buddy system so this person could work with them. It was in the IT field, so it was like dealing with IT tickets. So the first review period would say, right, we'll give you the easier tickets because this is what you need to get through. And the issue was really around his pace of work and his accuracy. But I thought they ran a very, very good process, and it looked very good in front of the tribunal because, you know, the manager didn't follow up after every single informal meeting. But what he did do is he scribbled notes down so that he had his own reminder. And, you know, we often say when we're talking about tribunals that documents speak volumes, right? It's all very well a witness standing on the witness stand and say, I had this meeting with him. But if you can point to a bit of paper going, here's my hand scribbled notes that are in my day book, and they go into the bundle of documents showing the date, you know, that tribunals lap that stuff up. And so it was a long old process. It was incredibly detailed. And I think that's understanding that tribunals, they live on a different planet, right? So they look at everything forensically, but it's our job and your job to put forward the business case and to provide all the details that they need to make a decision. And so, of course, he lost his claim. The tribunal thought that the company had supported him pretty well, and that, you know, it wasn't unreasonable for them to have taken the action they did. So, you know, but I would say that it's about having patience. They were incredibly patient through the whole PIP process, and it probably took much longer than they ever thought that it was going to. But yeah, that was good. But I think it would be remiss of us to say, okay, so that's the tribunal process. But also, Peter, we get clients come to us all the time and go, is there an alternative, right? So a typical thing would be, we've got somebody who's underperforming. They've been with us for quite some time. Nobody's really managed them. And, you know, really, we just need to move on. So that's probably more typical than how do we put somebody on a PIP? So, you know, then we're into the realms of, okay, let's think about having a protected conversation. Do you have what one of the HR professionals that I work with calls a war chest? In other words, a sum of money that you can use to pay this person off. Because very often that's quicker, it cuts to the chase, the business is happy. Yes, it might cost you some money, but ultimately, if you do the maths, it's probably still going to be cheaper than going to an employment tribunal if you marry up the cost of somebody's time. But it's not always that straightforward, is it?
It isn't. It isn't, but my view on that is there are a lot of steps that you can do to give you the leverage in terms of the negotiation. Because if you kind of trust a scenario where you're saying, hey, we can show that we raised this stuff with you informally, and we've been doing it for a while, we've been trying to upskill you, we've been trying to get you to the place you need to be, we've now started to escalate this, or we now need to escalate this into a formal performance. It kind of takes the wind out of an employee sales who wants to say, hey, I've never heard about these concerns before. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, if you are going to someone and they've never heard about those concerns before, then they're going to feel a bit more confident pushing back and saying, well, I don't feel these are legitimate concerns. So I think some of this background stuff we've been talking about feeds into how much negotiation leverage you've got, which feeds into how much it's going to cost you to shortcut the process. Because ultimately, you can look at this on a commercial basis. This is our legal risk. This is our legal exposure. This is how much we can pay NPM to help us out. This is how much we might be on the hook for if we go down for an unfair dismissal. Or we can pump some money into a deal and, you know, maybe both parties don't feel entirely satisfied, but that's probably the art of a good compromise, isn't it? There are other ways to look at it, but you need those strong foundations to put yourself in the best position, I think.
Otherwise, yeah, if you're going in cold because the employee has no awareness, then it's going to be extremely painful. So I think you probably need to do the initial steps first, start to put the breadcrumb trail in of the informal management process, so you're then able to have the conversation. Otherwise, it's expensive.
Just mindful of time, I think I'm going to wrap up in a second, but we've just had a couple more questions that I'd like to address. So someone's asked, what happens where there's an overlap with underperformance and redundancy? Well, probably redundancy, if the redundancy situation overtakes the underperformance, then you deal with it as a redundancy situation. Now, where the overlap might happen in practical terms is when it comes to scoring people in a selection process. But then it's all about, have you got objective selection criteria? Or is the scoring done in a fair way? And if you can demonstrate that the scores are fair and they're evidenced, then you're going to be in a pretty decent place. But what's probably going to happen is redundancy overtakes. Don't fall into the trap, because tribunals are really adept at spotting it and they really hate it, of getting someone who's an underperformer and saying, we're just going to make them redundant. Of course, it happens. We've seen it happen. We've seen it work. We've seen it not work. If tribunals, if they spot it, hate it, because they'll just say, look, this isn't a redundancy. It's a sham redundancy situation. What's really going on is underperformance, and you should manage it as a performance issue, you know, capability issue. So don't fall into that trap. Someone else has commented, if you use your war chest to wrongly pay an underperforming employee off, you're just letting others know that threatening a tribunal is good reason. Yeah, I mean, that's a fair point. I mean, again, I think it just comes back to a commercial decision. Equally, you don't want to be an employer that gets a reputation for just paying people off willy-nilly.
People do worry about that. Some will just go, we don't want tribunals, we don't want the publicity, because of course tribunal judgments get published online, and they would prefer to cut to the chase. But equally, we've got other clients who just say, no, absolutely, we don't want to send a message out that if you're rubbish at your job or you misbehave, you get paid off. It's a really, really valid point. And obviously we'd be delighted to handle tribunals because we enjoy them.
Would you recommend considering when an employee has more behavioural challenges that are harder to KPI or make smart? For example, someone who's resistant to change, obstructive, saying no to daily tasks. Yeah, that's a really good question, actually. We could probably talk for ages about it. My immediate thought is, well, actually, is it really a conduct issue and not a capability issue?
I totally agree. And that's remembering that that's always a really tricky one, because obviously when you're looking at dismissal and justifying it, you have to kind of pin your colours to the mast. What's the reason for dismissal? Does it fit into the potentially fair reasons? So if the behaviour is an issue, that could be conduct, particularly if they're refusing to follow lawful and reasonable instructions. That's definitely potential for misconduct. So it's remembering not to get confused between the two.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. Before we wrap up, just two quick favours to ask from me, if that's okay. First of all, if you're listening through Spotify in particular, and you're listening on your phone, you've got the ability to rate our podcast out of 5 stars. So if you're able to take a second to rate it, that really helps with our reach and visibility. I feel like it's a bit of a YouTuber there, Adrian. Like and subscribe. but if you don't mind...
Glad you're saying it.
Yeah, doing that helps us out massively. Equally, if you know anybody else that would benefit from attending these sessions, please spread the word. LinkedIn is a good medium for that, just a suggestion. So thank you in advance. We're back in 2 weeks' time, Thursday the 9th of May, and we're actually going to be looking at the employment tribunal process. So if you've not had the pleasure of living through a tribunal process, we're going to be looking at the mechanics of how to deal with something from inception. So from the point in time that ACAS get in touch and say, hey, we're calling you about early conciliation and this needs to be on your radar. So join us in a couple of weeks' time, same time, 11 a.m. In terms of our kind of takeaways for today, I think the first one is equip your managers with the skills that they need to manage. So that's fundamental. Obviously, we can help you with that. Come and talk to us if that would be useful. Secondly, have those good foundations in place. So those guardrails in place, policies, practices, transparency, people understanding what the standards are, what good performance looks like in their role, whatever that role might be within your organization. Thirdly, be clear in your expectations and manage informally at first. You know, you don't want to be escalating to a formal process every single time. There should be some informal management that sits behind that, and you know, like we've talked about, try and document it in a low level way, but encourage the managers to deal with it informally before it needs to escalate. As I said before, there should be no surprises by the time you get to a PIP process. Finally, commercial factors will often take over. It does take time and effort to performance manage somebody. There is risk involved sometimes. So, you know, be alive to the prospect of having a protected conversation, trying to resolve things a different way, you know, having a sensible discussion if that's a route that's open to you. With that, thanks very much for joining us today. We look forward to welcoming you in a couple of weeks' time. But for now, enjoy the rest of the week and we'll see you next time. Bye for now.
Bye.